Oh, I love that song. Thank you. That was fun. Puzzles abound everywhere this morning. You're probably wondering why there's a bunch of blank canvases here with nothing on there. A little riddle for us all. Part of that is they're blank because we need you to fill them in. We're trying to feature a lot of storytelling this year because that, of course, is what our season is all about, going into the looking glass, into stories. And so we're calling all of our visual artists here, we know you're out there, to tell us a story through your work. And so they're blank because we're hoping that you will fill them up. So if you have a visual story idea that you would like to tell, if you could contact Julie Cairns, she's right back there. You can find info in the Nexus Weekly about that as well. And then we'll have some additional stories. So you're probably wondering, how many of you could figure out the riddles? How many of you got the answer to them? Really? Wow, okay, they were pretty tough. Okay, a few of you. Let's take... Here it is. Unless you see it, darkness. That's my favorite, the dwarf one there. 7 seconds, right? That makes a certain amount of sense. If you say my name, I'm not there anymore. Who am I? Silence. Bonus points if anyone knows where those riddles came from. No, Life is Beautiful, the Oscar-winning foreign film starring Roberto Benigni. Yeah, it's a terribly sad movie, but some wonderful riddles there. Oh, riddles, puzzles. How many of you have been to these escape rooms you're doing? Huh? Absolutely tons of fun, escape rooms. You go in there, you're locked into a room, you have to figure out a way to get yourself out. I've done a number of these now, I find them incredibly exciting, and yet they drive me nuts. The premise, of course, is usually you're handcuffed in a room and there are just random things around. You have to somehow find a way to get yourself out. And I'm one of those people who believes in meaning, like any good person would. And so I start looking around the room for things that would make sense. And what frustrates me about escape rooms is everything is so random and arbitrary. And so the last time I was in an escape room, I spent like half the time, half an hour, doing this puzzle in the room because I thought it had a key or some sort of hint towards getting out of the room. And I sat there, I put the puzzle together, I looked high and low, top and bottom, and it turns out it was a red herring. It was a distraction. It meant nothing. And these rooms are vexing that way. Kristen always seems to stumble upon something accidentally and it leads to us moving on. I hate the idea that you can work with a puzzle and sometimes it might mean nothing. Or sometimes that it might mean, well, there really is no meaning here. It's all just random luck. And I want to talk about the idea of puzzles this morning in relation to Scripture. I want to return to the idea of story in Scripture this morning. And I want to do that with some insights from the Russian author and playwright Anton Chekhov. Many consider Chekhov to be one of the greatest writers of short fiction in all of history. And one of the things he was remembered for most was his principle about story, how to build a story. It was a dramatic principle, a basic dramatic principle that is aptly titled Chekhov's Gun. And he argued that all stories should run by the Chekhov's Gun principle, which simply means this. Every element in a story must be necessary. All irrelevant elements should be removed. And so, in storytelling, you have this idea. Only keep what is essential. Details that have no relevance to the plot, details that do not advance the story in some way, they should be discarded with. And so, in a story, Chekhov argued that a writer should never make false promises. You shouldn't set something up in a story that never comes into play. And this is how he describes it. This is his words. Remove everything that has no relevance to the story. If you say in the first chapter that there is a rifle hanging on the wall, in the second or third chapter, it must go off. If it's not going to be fired, it shouldn't be hanging there. Elsewhere, he says this, one must never place a loaded rifle on the stage if it isn't going to go off. It is wrong to make promises you don't mean to keep. And so for Chekhov, every setup in a story should be a promise of a payoff later. He says that's how good stories operate. And when we're under the spell of a really good story, we hardly notice this principle at play. It just feels good. It's wonderful. But what we do notice is when a story violates this principle. And no other story has violated as much as the TV show Lost. How many of you remember Lost? Fans, wasn't that like the greatest television show, well, for the first few seasons? It had some of the most remarkable, curious setups we've ever seen on television. These people crash on an island. Some of them survive. There's a smoke monster. There's this weird thing called the Dharma Project. There's time travel. All these mysteries are laid out in the first few seasons, and fans were like obsessed with this. Tell us how the mysteries turn out. But fans started to get a sense of dread as the last season came, the last few episodes came, and everyone was going, they don't have time. They don't have time to solve all these mysteries. And they didn't. The show ended and you were like, but what about the Dharma Project? You just brought it up and nothing happened. So many disappointed fans, because what ended up happening is the writers had a great idea for the show. They had no idea it would be popular. When it was, they had to keep the story going. They had no idea how to solve their own problems. And Chekhov's point is exactly that. Good stories don't do that. They provide setups and payoffs. It's this formula that good stories run by. Duncan Rayburn, he's a great little philosopher from South Africa. I'm indebted to his insights on story and theology. He makes two observations about this. First, he says this: in storytelling, consistency is important. We like coherence in stories. Coherence is driven by consistency. If you set up a mystery in the story you're telling, make sure you solve it by the end of the story. But he makes a second observation, which I think is interesting. He says the Chekhov's gun principle, or the idea of setup and payoffs, is actually how we construct all of meaning in life. It's how we make sense of the world. So we see life as a series of setups and payoffs. Consider why many of you going to school right now, university, college. Why are you doing that? That's the setup. And your hope is that the payoff is, oh, I'll get a job, hopefully one that's meaningful. There's a setup and a payoff. Or those of you who are married or looking to get married, what's the idea? The setup is, I want to get married to someone in the hopes that then I will have someone to share my life. It'll be a payoff later. Or those of you who are artists or have a craft or a skill, you put in all the time developing it. That's the setup. The payoff, right, is hopefully you develop it in such a way that it makes life more meaningful for you. You can make life beautiful with your hobby, your craft, your skill, your art. Or think about kids. Why do we have kids? This is a tricky one for me. I'm not yet sure what the payoff is, to be honest. Because I'm not convinced anyone thinks that changing diapers and going without sleep and going mad sometimes is the payoff. That's the setup. And we hope in the future, for those of us who have decided to have kids, what's the payoff? Well, we have a family unit. We get to speak into the lives of young individuals. When we're older, we can celebrate as friends our children that we've raised. That's the payoff, we hope. All of life is setup and payoff. And so Chekhov's gun principle, Duncan Rayburn observes, he's like, it plays out in all of life. That's how all of us see life. And he says, this is especially true in theology. He says, biblical writers were classic users of the Chekhov gun principle. And so what you'll have in Scripture, right, is the writers of Scripture are constantly pointing back to Scripture and saying, hey, do you remember that thing? Remember that? That was a setup. Now, here's the payoff. You have a classic example of this, 1 Corinthians 15. This is what Paul's saying. He says, for what I received, I passed on to you as of first importance, that Christ died for sins according to the Scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day according to the Scriptures. And so what Paul is saying, all of Scripture up to this point has been a setup for this. The payoff, Christ dying and being resurrected, that was always part of the plan. This is not some meaningless, random event. Setup, payoff. But here's part of the key that I'm really interested in. How you understand a setup in a story ultimately determines how you understand its payoff. Let me give you a few examples. If you come to Genesis, which we're going to start next week, if you come to Genesis and you believe the crux of the Genesis story happens in Genesis 3, if you believe that the setup of Genesis is to remind us how bad we are and how we're fallen, the payoff of Christ's death and resurrection will be directly tied to that. But if you see Genesis differently, the payoff will also be different. Or think about it this way. How you set up your idea of God will ultimately determine the payoff that you get. So if you believe God to be primarily a God of justice, then some kind of afterlife justice provides a pretty straightforward payoff, right? God is a just God. Someday, God will enact justice. That's a pretty direct payoff. Or if God is a God of justice, then the payoff is that what matters most in life right now is to do acts of justice. That's the payoff. Now, these things might be true, they might be false, they might be incomplete, but how you set something up determines the payoff you get from it. Have you ever been with someone and it's clear that you are not on the same page? Or that you're clearly seeing the same thing and yet at the same time seeing things very differently? This past summer, I traveled back to my holy land of the U.S. Southwest with my friends Riley and John. Explored deeper the riddles of the Anasazi, of course. And that brought us to Chaco Canyon. Never been there before. This is Chaco Canyon. This is the birthplace of the Anasazi, their Mecca, so to speak. It was a huge civilization about 1,000 years ago. Massive, massive ruins here. And we're touring this around, and it felt like this reverent experience. And it's so hot there. We're taking in these ruins, and I was just awed by it. They're just massive structures that have, because of the desert climate, withstood the test of time. And I was just like, this is so beautiful. And we've been out there for hours, and suddenly my friend Riley's like, do you mind if I read you a passage of scripture? And I got to be honest, I'm one of those guys, I'm like, really? Do we need to do that right now? That was, I'm like, what? I'm like, all right. So this, he's looking at the ruins. It goes to Isaiah. And this is what he reads with a fairly authoritative voice. Your country is desolate. Your cities burned with fire. Your fields being stripped by foreigners right before you, laid waste as when overthrown by strangers. Daughter Zion is left like a shelter in a vineyard. And he keeps going through Isaiah with this like apocalyptic doom passage. And I stood there quietly for a moment trying to make it seem like I was actually contemplating what he was saying. And finally, I'm like, what are you talking about? Why are you pronouncing apocalyptic doom? He's like, well, I see these ruins. All I see is death and destruction, a reminder that all empires fall. And I was like, I'm seeing this very differently. I said, this to me is a beautiful connection to the past. It's a symbol of human ingenuity. I see this as beautiful, a testament that we're all connected together. Where he was seeing death and destruction, I was seeing something very different. And we were looking at the exact same thing. And then later we were hiking out in the desert and it was just scorching hot. 45 degrees, we were trying to make it to these Anasazi ruins and we're hiking and we're all together and we take a break under a shady tree. And Riley again makes an observation about the landscape. He's like, this landscape is just brutal. It's filled with death. It's unhospitable. It's bleak. It's uninviting. At this point, my other friend John jumped in and said, are you blind? This is a place of life. This is a place of resilience. It's a place of hope. It's a place of adaptability. What a beautiful place that life can survive and thrive even in these harsh conditions. I was like, wow. Two of us, three of us, looking at the same thing, seeing something very, very different. And it reminds me of this idea. You see, how you set something up in your mind determines the payoff that you get from it. Or what you go looking for is what you will find. What is sometimes going on inside of you determines what you see and experience on the outside. And I think this is precisely, or at least somewhat, what Jesus is after in Matthew chapter 7. Sermon on the Mount, Jesus says, ask and it will be given to you. Seek and you will find. Knock and the door will be opened to you. How you set something up, what it is you're looking for, will determine ultimately what you will find. And the interesting thing to me is that in Scripture, the writers play with this setup, payoff, expectation in some really bizarre and remarkable ways. They play around with setup, payoff structure in ways I would say probably most biblical scholars today would say that's a little unorthodox. Let me give you two examples of this. This is from Hosea in the Old Testament. Hosea is speaking, of course, about the Israelites, people of God at the time. This is what it says in Hosea. Yet the Israelites will be like the sand on the seashore, which cannot be measured or counted. In the place where it is said to them, you are not my people, they will be called children of the living God. I will plant her for myself in the land. I will show my love to the one I called not my loved one. I will say to those people called not my people, you are my people. And they will say, you are my God. Now, this is a classic setup in Scripture. God's showing Hosea something. There's a time coming when the people of Israel who have turned their back on God, walked away from God, forsaken God, there's a time coming when they will be God's people again. They are, at the moment, outsiders. But God will once again bring them back as his own people. So there's this transference of identity coming. But then in the New Testament, you have Paul, who's talking about Jews and Gentiles together in Romans, and he cites this exact passage. Paul says this in Romans 9. Exact text from Hosea. I will call them my people who are not my people. I will call her my loved one who is not my loved one. And in the very place where it is said to them, you are not my people, there they will be called children of the living God. It's an exact quote from Hosea, but Paul reveals the payoff is actually Gentiles becoming God's people. And so he sees the setup and payoff very differently. Paul claims this is God's idea all along. The Gentiles will be God's people. This is what the setup in Scripture was pointing to all along. But the crazy thing is this. Hosea wasn't talking about God being merciful to Gentiles. If you read Hosea in context, he's referring to the stubborn people of Israel. And so you could say Paul intentionally reads Hosea out of context. Or you could say Paul reads Hosea wider, more imaginatively than was originally intended. And the payoff is much larger. By the way, if someone ever says to you, you know, I think you're reading that out of context in Scripture, be like, I'm just following Paul. Just following Paul here. Let me give you another example. This one is crazy to me. 1 Corinthians, Paul is talking to the church there, and he's going to cite back to the Exodus event, them wandering in the wilderness. This is what Paul says. I do not want you to be ignorant of the fact, brothers and sisters, that our ancestors were all under the cloud and that they all passed through the sea. They were all baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. They all ate the same spiritual food and drank the same spiritual drink. For they drank from the spiritual rock that accompanied them, and that rock was Christ. So Paul's reflecting back on the story of Israel, wandering in the desert, and he references something that's really peculiar here. If in the Old Testament you follow the story of the Israelites wandering in the desert for 40 years, you will find two occasions where God provides them with water from a rock. In Exodus 17, the people have just begun their journey. Like, we should go back to Egypt. We're so thirsty. It's really hot out in the desert. We have no water. God provides water to them from a rock. But then in Numbers 20, towards the end of their 40-year journey, something very similar happens, but it's in a very different place. In a totally different place, God again provides water to them from a rock. This is where things get peculiar. In the ancient Jewish interpretive tradition, some people believed they must be the same rock. It's the same rock being used in both stories. which makes no sense at all. These two stories happen in very different locations at two very different times. So what interpreters did in order to make this kind of make sense is they came up with this idea that this special rock followed the people around through the wilderness. Right? To call it the curious case of the traveling rock. Now back to Corinthians. Paul is citing these passages and he says, here's the payoff. That rock that was apparently following the people around in the wilderness, yeah, that was Jesus. What? Jesus is the spiritual rock that followed the Israelites in the desert. And so within Scripture itself, you have Paul relying on what might be a bit of a dubious interpretation of what happened in the Exodus wilderness, and then is taking that and interpreting the payoff of that as Jesus. And this is the weird thing. You can look high and low in the Old Testament for this traveling rock. You will not find it. It is not there. There's simply a story about a rock and water here and another one there. But this is the weird interpretive process that Paul goes through. It's a setup and the payoff, they don't completely align. And what the New Testament writers understood, though, was this. They began to realize that they could interpret the Old Testament very broadly, and they allowed themselves to take what I would say some artistic licenses with the text. But why? After Christ, the New Testament writers began to question all of the setups and payoffs they had ever known. After Christ, they realized perhaps there were setups that they had no clue were even there, and suddenly they thought maybe there's some payoffs that we haven't even considered. And it makes their interpretive ground just so much wider and more imaginative. Duncan Rayburn, he says this, the reason for this is in the ancient Jewish tradition, the idea was this, a minimum of revelation and a maximum of interpretation. And so for us, the question is not just how do we understand a story in its original context. That's important, but what that oftentimes does is this, it makes those of us who know our history, we become the guardians of interpretation. So it's that, but it's also how do we figure out how these setups pay off now, today, in light of Jesus? And this is where I think things get chaotic and messy and makes a lot of people nervous, alarming to some Christians. Whoa, 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 whoa. If the rules aren't clear on interpretation, it will be chaos. And yet this is the hermeneutic Paul used, and this is where things for me get really exciting and interesting. See, when Anton Chekhov came up with his gun principle, he was thinking about storytelling in a very limited way. One book or one play, and if you describe a loaded gun, it better go off later on in the story. But the Bible is not just one story. It's overlapping stories. Many stories from different times, different periods, different authors reshaping and interpreting older texts down the road. They're doing things with the stories here that a single story cannot do. And beyond that, the story of Scripture is not a closed text, a closed canon in the way that it's a closed story. The story is still unfolding. It's not done. And so what Rayburn says is this. This is what makes Scripture absolutely ludicrously interesting. And I concur. It brings us to part of the point this morning. In Chekhov's system, narratives exist in a closed world where everything fits perfectly together like a puzzle. Every setup has a payoff. In Chekhov's own stories, his short fiction stories, they're all very clear, coherent. They lack ambiguity. What I would say for us is this. That's not how life works. And I don't think it's how theology works either. In my own life, there are a whole lot of things I look back on and go, that setup had no payoff. Or this random thing happened to me and I have no idea what the setup was there. And I think it's the same as we come to Scripture, as we begin a journey through some of the best stories of Scripture. There are going to be bizarre setups that don't seem to have a payoff. And we're going to discover payoffs along the way that maybe we've missed. And this is what I'm sure of in terms of Genesis. What I hope to help us see is incredible setups and payoffs we had no idea were there at all. And I find this incredibly humbling because what I'm coming to understand about myself and the puzzle of Scripture is that it continually seems to reveal new things to me, and I find myself constantly discovering what I consider richer, more robust, fuller ideas within Scripture that I've just never seen before. And those are the things I want to share with you in the coming weeks. But what I want to ask us of us this morning is this. Before we dive in, I want you to consider the setup. What is your setup? How you understand a setup will ultimately determine the payoff that you get. And so if you come at this book as basic instructions before leaving Earth, if that's your, that's a thing for Bible. No, you didn't get that, okay. B-I-B-L-E, basically. Whatever. If you come at this book as an instruction manual, what you will get out of it is instructions. But you might also miss how much more it has to offer. If you come at this book as a primitive piece of writing that we have evolved beyond and has nothing to say to us, that's what you'll get. If you come at this book literally, your payoff will be that you will find literal stories, but also stories that are maybe hard to understand. Or if you come at this book looking for a reason to doubt God, if you come at this book looking for a reason to abandon God, you will find it. You will get that payoff. But if you come at this book with Jesus as the interpretive grid, as the New Testament writers did, if you come at this book not as a closed story, as an open and ongoing story, I believe the payoff will be this. You will find it becomes more nuanced, messy, chaotic, psychological, and beautiful. And the book will suddenly dispel of our ridiculous categories of is it literally true or just a mere myth. Your payoff might be larger than you imagine. But what I can promise you this is it will not play by the rules of Chekhov's gun, a neat and tidy story where everything is tied up without ambiguity. In his book, The Bible Made Impossible, Christian Smith says this, the Bible functions something like a particular enormous jigsaw puzzle with a huge number of pieces. This is a very unusual puzzle. Different pieces can fit together in different ways to form distinctly different pictures. Nearly all of them are portraits of people. One is of a scowling old man, another of a sweet young girl, yet another a pregnant woman, and still a fourth is a tired-looking police officer. The puzzlers discover that many of the pieces that make one portrait can be rearranged differently, with some pieces removed and others added to make other portraits. Not only that, but in any given picture, enough of the pieces fit together to fill in most of the image, but not all of it. Every picture, no matter how well it is put together, still has some missing puzzle pieces. This is a rich quote. I love it on many levels. There's always going to be pieces that don't fit because we're not in a closed story. And as we work through some of these stories in Genesis, you might hear me say often, I have no idea what's going on here. You might hear me say, I'm not sure how this piece fits. That's fine by me, at least. There will always be holes in our theology, always pieces missing from the puzzle because the story is still is open and unfinished. But I also love this because it helps me understand the way we make sense of the world. I think what Smith gets right here is that we're always building a puzzle in a way that makes sense to us. If you see God as a police officer, that is how you're going to build your puzzle. If you see God or Scripture as a tired old man, that's how you'll build your puzzle. But we must constantly remember to question our own setups and payoffs because they don't account for the whole thing. There are different ways to set up the puzzle, which brings us to the IKEA effect and the do-it-yourself craze. I can't stand IKEA, nor can I stand making things on my own, but this has become a thing, an actual Wikipedia thing you can look up. Anyway, the IKEA effect is this. We have a cognitive bias in which consumers place a disproportionately high value on products they partially created. which means this. It helps explain the phenomenon of IKEA. Why IKEA does so well is they say, here's a beautiful chair, you put it together. And in our brains, we go, wow, I made this thing. Or the do-it-yourself craze. I'm going to make a coffee table. It doesn't matter if it's crooked and it doesn't look great. I made it myself. This is interesting to me because as humans, we tend to think that things we make or discover are much more significant than they really are. And I think this applies to theology as well. All of us sort of get this gigantic box of IKEA pieces that we call scripture. And we pull it out and either through church, books we're reading, authors that are speaking into us, conversations with friends, we all sort of start building up our theology together, our dogmas together. And of course, this is much more complicated than the most complex IKEA product, but we all build up our beliefs and our dogmas through this process, and oftentimes we become quite attached to it. I built this. I put it together. It's my do-it-yourself project. And it makes sense to us, even if it might not to others. And what I want to ask of all of us is this, maybe we need to gently call our own payoffs and setups into question. What exactly is the setup in Scripture? Have I understood it correctly? Have I gotten something wrong? Is there something I don't understand? Are there setups that I haven't noticed? Are there payoffs where I miss something? I think the reality is in life and in theology, it's always a work in progress. I would say this. I would suggest some of you are perhaps stuck. Some of us have stopped participating in the drama of Scripture. We have our puzzles, and they make sense to us. They explain Scripture and God to us. Maybe that's good enough. But the reality is, you know all the pieces aren't there. There's something missing. And so maybe we need to question how we've set this whole thing up, question the payoffs we've become certain about. I'm going to ask Dave to come. I want to say this quickly before I close. Please hear me. What I am not saying is that any setup or payoff will do. I'm not a relativist that way. Theology is a vital activity. And what I love about Paul is he was very eccentric when it came to interpreting Scripture, but he was really thoughtful and deliberate and careful about it all. Not all interpretations are equally valid or commendable. There's still, though, better and worse ways of understanding setups and payoffs. Well, the point is this. How we set things up is going to deeply affect the payoff. And sometimes our squabbles and doubts with faith and theology are due to the fact that we set the whole thing up wrong. And to me, nowhere is that more obvious than in Genesis. I think we've set the thing up wrong for far too long. But let's pay attention to how we set it up, because where we start will often determine where we end. So let's begin the puzzle again next week. We'll dive in, let's go back to the setup, and maybe then we'll have a better idea of where it will take us and what the payoff is.